Welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. Today we'll be delving a little deeper into our latest special issue, Survivorship Issues in Radiation Oncology. I'm Saif Ahmed, and in this podcast episode, first I'll be talking to Dr. Raj Jenner, consultant clinical oncologist at Addenbrookes Hospital, Cambridge, who is the guest editor of this issue. He'll be talking us through the highlights of this special issue, and then I'll be talking to Dr. Claire Donnellan and Dr. Mark Teo about their article looking at late GI toxicity after radiotherapy. Raj, could you tell us why you feel that it's important for clinical oncology to cover survivorship in a special issue?
Sure. I think that the role of the clinical oncologist is changing, particularly in the last few years. And there are a lot of pressures on our time now and changes in how we're perceived as specialists providing care. So we've seen shifts in new to follow-up ratios and early discharge of patients to the community. But at the end of the day, we are the people that are responsible for looking after patients after they've completed their treatment and signposting patients towards appropriate care if they get long-term effects. And I think it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to do because we've less time to do it. And actually, because as we get the feeling in some of these papers, you have to ask quite subtle questions in order to investigate patient symptoms. And so for me, that was the real interest in putting together this special edition, because it's an opportunity to hear from some experts in the management of some of the common side effects of cancer therapy, and also perhaps some new approaches at how we might solve this problem.
What sort of areas have you covered within this special issue?
So we've got a couple of articles that are site-specific, looking at survivorship issues in breast cancer. That was very interesting to look at the side effect profiles for different radiotherapy techniques, and also to look at the effect of new technologies, so heart sparing, breath hold, possibly even things like IMRT and proton beam therapy. Moving on to my area, I was very interested now being involved in the treatment of patients with cerebral metastases, to look at neurocognitive function in patients with oligometastatic disease. And a very interesting discussion we had about the fact that this is actually a complex and multifactorial process, and it's not just about the radiation dose and treatment. But also, I think it was interesting to hear about ideas about sparing parts of the brain, whether that can be done safely, sparing the hippocampus, and whether there might be drug treatments as well that might actually help in terms of protecting the brain against some of the long-term side effects of treatment.
And following your experience of guest editing this special issue, do you have any broad recommendations for oncologists out there in the field?
Yes, I think read the articles. That's the first thing. You'll learn a lot, because I did. I think that what we need to focus on increasingly is that if we have time with the patient or time to hear from the patient, we have effective mechanisms to pick up on warning signs for potential problems. And there's a couple of ways we might do that. It might be about educating patients to manage their own symptoms more effectively, and therefore getting in touch with us when they pick up certain trigger symptoms. It might be about using more questionnaires. We have an interesting article looking at analysing questionnaire data on side effects from clinical trials. And it may be that of the dozens of questions that patients get asked in clinical trials, there's only one or two things you actually really need to ask about that act as a trigger to suggest that there may be some long-term toxicity. Or it may just be the way that we inform our own discussions with the patient. If you have a better understanding of what the key factors are going to be, then it means you can direct your questions, and it may only take a few seconds to explore with the patient. And some of these things are quite uncomfortable. We've got an article on psychosexual issues of particularly after pelvic radiotherapy. And I think that if we can give pointers to people, a few specific things to ask that might help open up discussions, that would be helpful.
Raj, thank you very much for that excellent summary. And we'll all look forward to reading the articles within the special issue.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to now be joined by Dr. Mark Teo, an academic clinical lecturer working with the Radiotherapy Research Group at the University of Leeds, and Dr. Claire Donnellan, a consultant gastroenterologist at Leeds Gastroenterology Institute at Leeds Teaching Hospital's NHS Trust. They are both authors of an overview article in this special issue on the important area of prevention and management of radiation-induced late gastrointestinal toxicity. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Claire, can I start by asking you to tell us about the scale of the problem and how these gastrointestinal side effects may affect patients?
It's difficult to know the number of patients that are suffering from pelvic radiation disease. Estimates by Jarvis Andrews, who is a gastroenterologist based at the Marsden, who's been very much a leader in this area, and also Macmillan, the cancer charity, have estimated that about 90,000 people suffer from this disease. Now, how are those numbers obtained? Well, we know that about 17,000 patients have pelvic radiotherapy per year. And following this, the majority of patients have some kind of permanent change to their bowels. However, that may be a change from going once per day to twice per day, which would not be very clinically relevant. So when you look at those having such severe symptoms that their quality of life is reduced, this can also be affecting about 50% of patients, which is several thousand patients per year. The unfortunate thing is we don't really know confirmation of these numbers because there is a large cohort of patients who never come forward for clinical help as they see it as an inevitable consequence of their radiotherapy and that nothing can be done. At the extreme end of the spectrum, about 5% of patients can have very severe symptoms even at 10 years after their radiotherapy. And this can include problems such as fistulae, abnormal connections between a bit of bowel and something else such as bowel, bladder or skin, strictures in the bowels leading to bowel obstruction, or even transfusion-dependent bleeding. And these are patients who often are beginning to have one operation after another and end up on parenteral nutrition or have very severe consequences. More commonly, a very disabling problem can be rectal bleeding due to radiation proctopathy, and even this can occur in 2 to 20% of all patients.
This is clearly a very large problem. Is anything known about the pathophysiology about why this is happening?
Well, we understand that when you receive radiotherapy, there is inflammation with associated edema. Over time, this can end up in causing quite significant fibrosis of the tissue. Now, this has two effects. It can alter the architecture of the tissue, but more importantly, the function of the tissue. And sometimes that can be the problem in this situation, in that there may not be obvious anatomical change that we can see on cross-sectional imaging, and yet the functional changes are so severe that they can lead to a real change in symptoms such as diarrhea. The other pathological changes that can occur include ischemia, and this ironically often leads to significant bleeding, and you can get atrophy and necrosis of the tissue, and that's what can cause strictures and fistulae.
And how can we identify the patients who are suffering with this problem?
I think that's the key to this area. We need to first focus on education. Now, that includes education of patients such that when they finish their oncology therapy and they're discharged back to their GP, they know that there is a risk of long-term complications. So when these develop some years later, they can link it to their previous radiotherapy. We also need to educate GPs such that when patients with previous radiotherapy go with GI issues, they know that these are treatable issues and ones that can be dealt with, not just reassuring the patients and saying it's an inevitable consequence, and also to some extent educating oncologists who may be wary of asking patients about their symptoms because they also worry that there is nothing to be done.
And you mentioned treatments. What kind of things are available?
Normally, we can get certainly improved control of all of the symptoms that patients have. The Marsden in particular has worked extremely hard to produce a very comprehensive algorithm. Now, when I compare these patients to other patients that I treat, the difference is that they often have multiple symptoms, but also multiple causes to their symptoms. So you have to take a much, much broader brush when you're examining and managing these patients. If you, for instance, have someone with diarrhea and you simply look for inflammation of the large bowel, colitis, you will miss the other causes of diarrhea that they may have, which may be bile salt diarrhea, only detected by a particular scan, bacterial overgrowth only detected if you look for it with either a breath test or doing an endoscopy and taking aspirate, or things like celiac disease, which are actually very common in the general population. So these patients are different in that because they have multiple causes for their symptoms, unless you take a very systematic approach and address all of the possible causes and then treat those causes, you're not going to make headway. We now have the tools to do that with the excellent algorithm produced by Jarvis Andreev and his team at the Marsden. So as gastroenterologists now, we have the tools both to systematically look for the different causes of the different symptoms that patients present with, but also the Marsden algorithm gives us a very clear guide as to how to manage each particular condition that we detect.
So once you've recognised the problem, how effective are treatments at alleviating the patient's symptoms?
Pretty effective. We have patients who have new GI symptoms after their radiotherapy, and they're the ones that we can often find particular causes and treat. There's another cohort of patients who actually had pre-existing irritable bowel syndrome symptoms or other GI problems, and it's probably unrealistic to expect that with that background and then new symptoms on top, possibly linked to the radiotherapy, that we're going to eradicate all of those symptoms, but we can often get them back to their previous baseline.
Mark, I just wanted to bring you in on the radiotherapy aspect of things. Can anything be done during radiotherapy treatment itself to reduce the risk of late GI toxicity?
From our review, at present, there remains actually very limited evidence base of what interventions we can do. I think starting with the pharmacological intervention, the results have been very mixed with all the different agents tested, and a lot of these agents were tested in poor quality trials. There are, however, a few promising agents, such as amifostin, statins, ACE inhibitors, and probiotics, but there is a need for higher quality randomized control data for these pharmacological agents. This leaves us with interventions in relation to lifestyle and the radiotherapy technique. Now, with lifestyle, it's widely recognized that smoking, cigarette smoking especially, does affect the acute and late toxicity profile. And this would be the one key area that, as oncologists, we could emphasize to patients the need to stop smoking, both in terms of the efficacy of the treatment as well as its effects on toxicity as well as longer-term health. With regards to the radiotherapy techniques, this is a very rapidly advancing area in the last decade. There is now potential room for improvements in target volume delineation of the cancer, and with newer imaging modalities such as introduction of MRI-based planning. MRI-based planning has been shown to provide greater soft tissue definition, which in small studies have shown to reduce the clinical target volume by about 20% and hence reduce the amount of normal tissue irradiated. There's developments in 4D CT planning that also allow a reduction in the internal motion margins for especially upper gastrointestinal cancers, where in the past these cancers were very difficult to treat due to the high toxicity. With these new imaging techniques, radiotherapy to these areas are far better tolerated. Improvements in image guidance radiotherapy. Besides improving accuracy of treatment, it does allow reduction in margins used for setup error and hence, once again, reducing normal tissue treated. And in retrospective studies, this has been reported to reduce late rectal toxicity. Now, the key improvement is in relation to the use of intensity-modulated radiotherapy. This improved conformality reduces the normal tissue doses, especially in relation to high doses to normal tissue. It does come in exchange with a low-dose bath throughout the rest of the body. The significance of this low-dose bath still remains unclear, and we will need to audit this prospectively as a community. But there is high interest in RMRT, and there are randomized control trials in cervical and prostate cancer, which has shown reductions in gastrointestinal toxicity, both acute and late. Other measures include newer engineering and newer immobilization devices, which are far more acceptable to patients and more comfortable, such as belly board devices, which allows the small bowel volume to be reduced. However, with regards to these newer advanced radiotherapy techniques, once again, because they are new, the evidence base for these late toxicities are still remain very limited. And there is a need to improve our reporting, especially our auditing of our outcomes of these newer technologies, as ethically, it would be difficult to design a randomized controlled trial testing these techniques, randomizing patients to an advanced approach, which theoretically and dosimetrically is better. And what we really need is prospective auditing of our results as these newer technologies are rolled out throughout the country.
Having reviewed the literature, do you have any recommendations for the wider physician community?
Yeah, I think there are three aspects to this. The absolute principle one is to be able to recognise that this is a true problem and, more importantly, that it's utterly treatable. The way we go about doing that is through education of patients. Now, interestingly, when you do questionnaire studies for patients, the evidence would seem to be that people like to be informed much more than they currently are about late effects, and that they need that information to be repeated over time, even following the end of treatment. And that's clear guidance, really, that we should be doing that more, so that when patients are discharged from the oncology community, they have an aftercare package that would guide them into what to do when future problems arise. And then, of course, these patients will attend their GP surgery. And this is a very niche area for GPs. So somehow we need to get the information out to GPs that, again, these problems are treatable and that patients should be referred to a gastroenterologist with an interest in this area, who then take the approach described earlier using the Marden algorithm if necessary, and that these patients can get better with the appropriate management and treatment. And as part of that, there may be benefit of an MDT approach where these patients are discussed more in a multidisciplinary setting that not only involves gastroenterologists but also involves oncologists, as a bit of feedback and to get the wider message out there. And Macmillan are beginning to trial this approach, but it's in its very early stages.
From the oncology perspective, clinically, what I think one of the key things for oncologists is to be aware that pelvic radiation disease is treatable. From both my personal observation as an oncologist as well as from a national survey of oncologists a few years ago, is clinicians are nihilistic about this condition, feeling that there's nothing that can be done. And hence, in consultations, they may potentially avoid discussing these issues, as it could potentially lead to a difficult consultation, as they feel that there's nothing they could offer, and partly they may feel guilty that it is their treatment which has resulted in the patient's symptoms. But hence, there is a need for clinicians to be aware that things can be done. And for these patients, there are typically multiple pathologies played in here, with most patients having two or more diagnoses causing their symptoms, of which one-third are not related to their radiotherapy treatment. Hence, there is potential for things to be done for these patients. There is plenty of information available to clinicians who come across these situations. Macmillan have information leaflets, booklets, and guidance available online that clinicians can access if needed. On top of this, our review article as well. Other things that we need to be doing as oncologists is to audit our outcome data, and what we really need to be using more of is validated patient-reported outcomes, such as the Lent Soma questionnaires, and we need to be using this throughout the patient pathway, from pre-treatment all the way through their follow-up pathway. And this patient-reported outcomes provide a more thorough assessment. It has greater correlation with symptoms and patient quality of life. And if patients are completing these questionnaires, for example, in the waiting room or the day before coming for their follow-up appointment, it does prompt these symptoms for the patient to bring to discussion and can potentially speed up the consultation. It also emphasizes patient that we as clinicians feel that these symptoms are important. These patient-reported outcomes will also allow us to continuously audit our outcomes, especially as newer radiotherapy techniques are developed. The best example of this is the Royal College of Radiologists UK-wide audit of intensity-modulated radiotherapy in anal cancer, and this with the recommendation for implementation of IMRT throughout the whole of the UK for anal cancer treatment. This audit will help us quantify the benefits of these new techniques this brings us to research, and as I mentioned earlier, is there is a need for high-quality randomized controlled trials, both in looking at prophylactic measures of newer pharmacological agents, of newer radiotherapy techniques. These trials need to be statistically powered and well-designed, and the best approach to achieve this is to ensure early engagement and support and collaboration with clinical trials units across the country. As clinicians, we need to use patient-reported outcomes, especially in our research trials as well. We also need to correlate our patient-reported outcomes with our radiotherapy dosimetric data, which would give us a fuller picture of the different elements resulting in our gastrointestinal toxicity. And as these different elements change with newer technologies, newer treatments, we can quantify these results and assess things better and improve things better.
Excellent. Thank you very much, both of you, Claire and Mark, for a really, really educational and informative discussion. Thanks very much.